Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 99-year-old Jack Kappeler of Bakersfield, California. He grew up in Alameda, California, which we were just discussing on this program in recent weeks, thanks to a visit to the USS Hornet there. If you're ever in Corpus Christi, Texas, you'll find a different museum ship. It's the carrier USS Lexington, the very ship Jack Kappeler would end up flying off during the latter stages of World War II. If you walk out on that flight deck, maybe you can imagine the time that Jack had to land there without a tail hook on his F-4U Corsair.
Well, that was a pretty common accomplished problem, landing on a carrier. The typical wasn't unusual.
Well, you know, I want to talk to you about that because, you know, taking off on a runway and landing on a runway is challenging enough for some people, and a lot of things can go wrong. This idea of launching off a carrier and then landing on it again, how'd you feel about that?
Well, I'd watched it going on at Alameda for years.
Right.
And I've thought about it and studied it, and I fit right into it. Mm-hmm. I had no problems with it. Landing was harder than takeoff, of course. And then later they came along with a propulsion to get you off the deck without the engine power,
So you had carrier takeoffs with and without the catapult?
Yeah.
Can you help us understand the difference, how big a difference that made? What was it like before that, and then give us the after?
Well, when you take off before, when you hit the end of the deck, it's just you drop off and you're in nothingness. And you're waiting for the engine to catch up with you, to get you going. And your heart's in your mouth every time you take off. But the catapult, they get you going 100 and some miles an hour. It's like hitting an air brake, but the prop takes over. And you stop in the middle of the air. And then the engine takes over and you start flying, which it makes you think, but it's wonderful.
So a little less stressful with the catapult?
Oh, yeah, very much so, yeah.
And as you describe that, I'm thinking of your brother in those B-25s off the Hornet, because I've talked to guys who were on the Hornet for that and also guys who are on the Big E, the Enterprise next door watching all this. And they say they were taking bets to see if those B-25s were going to clear the water, you know, make it over there. Did you ever ask him about that takeoff?
The guy that worries about it is the pilot. He was a navigator. So he's sitting at his table back there and probably didn't even know how bad that takeoff was.
And I'm sure there was a time or two you saw something similar unfold aboard the Lexington.
Oh, sure. A lot of times. You have an engine, something wrong with the engine, and it misses a couple of times. You end up in the water. That was a common occurrence. And it's 50-50 chance you'll get out if you hit the water, whether you get out of the cockpit before the plane goes down deep enough you can't get out of it. So it was always a risk.
So there was a ship named the Lexington that was sunk in the Battle of the Coral Sea, and you end up on its namesake that replaced it, right? The second Lexington, the 16. What was it like when you got put aboard that carrier? What can you give us the atmosphere or the camaraderie, the relationship with other guys?
Oh, it was at the Navy. It was pretty good. Everybody fit right in, and they didn't know what history the carrier had until you're aboard for a while. And the crew will let you know right away what they had done. But as an air group, you come aboard and you're like a bunch of unwanted. That they take you in and feed you, and that's it. And set you on your way.
And you were flying F-6Fs at first, right?
Yeah.
You don't hear a lot about that plane. There are a lot of planes that get more headlines than the Hellcat.
The Hellcat was more popular than the Corsair. Corsair came in at the end of the war.
Yeah. Well, tell me about the Hellcat. What was it like to fly, and what are some of the things you got to do in Hellcats?
A wonderful airplane, almost flew itself. And other guys would say the same thing, I think. Mm-hmm. Stable, wasn't as fast as a Corsair, had the same engine. But other than that, no, the Hellcat was a durable airplane, all metal. Corsair had fabric wings. You take a hit in your wing, and you probably lose your airplane. Hellcat, you get a hit in the metallic part and it takes some of it away, but usually still flyable. Mm-hmm. Pretty durable, like the F-4F.
So you trained in the Hellcat, but by the time you guys shipped out, the squadron had transferred to F4Us. So you're on the carrier, you're shipping out. The war's still going on. What are you thinking when you're leaving the States and heading overseas, knowing there's a war that you're going into?
I think you get used to that. What would you think? I don't think it bothered any of us. It's the thing you had to do.
You know, because some guys have shared, oh, I thought I was invincible. Other guys said, well, I wasn't sure if I was going to come home. I wasn't sure if I'd see my girl again or my parents again. Did you have any?
You tried not to think that way, I think. I tried not to think that way. Be positive, and you think you're going to come home.
So tell me about it. Where'd you guys leave from, and where'd you go?
Left from Alameda. You go out and join a task force. They put the task force together, and you go about your business.
So were you flying combat air patrols, or were there specific targets you were supposed to hit, or...
It all differed, depending where you were going, yeah.
So most of us have never done this, right? So we've seen movies and we've read books and we have an idea of maybe a few seconds of action in the air. But for a day as a Navy fighter pilot aboard a carrier, when does that day start? What are the things you do? And maybe walk us through that whole process if you can.
It's with you all the time. And you're always ready to take off when the whistle blows, have your gear on, and get your airplane out there. So you live that way just all the time.
And, you know, just for example, is this something where at whatever time in the morning they call your squadron together, you're in a briefing room and getting some kind of idea of what you're going to strike?
You don't even get that much time. Most time it's assigned to sound a horn or whatever it is to get you up and out. And they'll brief you on a mission quickly and you're gone. It's over with before you know it.
Well, can you slow that down for me a little bit and walk me through the process? Like, what steps do you have to take? What has to happen to get you off the carrier and to where you're going?
Every pilot has a wingman. You go two guys together, mm-hmm. and you're both briefed at the same time. So you should know what's going on. And then that goes all the way down through the group that everybody's on the same page. Every flight's going to be different what your objective is.
Can you give me an example of maybe a mission that you flew?
No, it's hard to say. Most of them are very short period of time because we didn't have to fly very far to get to objectives. Mm-hmm. Like Guam and Japan at the end of the war. You're right offshore. They didn't have much of a defense. What little they did have, they were good at. I lost my teeth on one of the
We were talking about targets, right? So you said you take off, your wingman is very important. Did you have the same wingman on most of those missions?
Yep.
Who was that?
Art Lindelman, this guy is still alive in Oklahoma.
Really?
Yeah. He lived and ate and drank and went to the John together.
I haven't heard that last one too often. I mean, usually that's a solo sport. And so you two
be in sync.
In sync or in stink? Well, okay, so you two are still in contact?
Oh, yeah.
And can you give us a sense of how close that relationship was? I mean, how well you two knew each other? You just told me the things you did together, but how close were you?
It's as close as my brother and I were ever. Mm. Probably closer because we bunked together for so long.
Yeah. And once you're up in the air, you need to really rely on each other.
Yep. Every little instinct. You know his and he knows yours. Yeah.
So how would that work? You're off the carrier and you know where you're headed and what the target is.
Right.
What do the two of you do from takeoff to that return landing?
Well, if most of the time you'd be strafing something. Mm-hmm. So you'd stay two planes together, try never to separate. Hit your target, then you'd have a point to gather and organize and go back to the ship. And it just was automatic. You go to your point and rotate it, circulate around until you see the rest of the group and get together and head back.
And what kind of targets were you guys typically hitting?
Well, they varied. Mainly the first in Japan was their industrial plants, hitting those with heavy ordnance, probably 500-pound bombs, and destroying factories and anything that gave them the support. Yeah. I got to go ashore and see some of the things we did.
Really?
Yeah.
And you're talking about strafing. And so you're strafing vehicles, positions, anti-aircraft guns, what?
You wanted, yeah. But when you're strafing, that's a separate mode. You wouldn't be bombing at the same time.
And if you're strafing targets on the ground, sometimes there's stuff coming back up at you, right?
Always.
That sounds a little nerve-wracking to me.
Well, you get used to it.
Mm-hmm. What does that require, like mentally, psychologically, when you're doing that and you know you could be shot down?
A real dumbbell.
Out of sight, out of mind? Out of sight, out of mind?
How'd I ever get here?
Yeah. Well, and maybe you can share that with me. What were some of the hazards that you had to be prepared for?
Just getting the airplane taken apart and ending out in the water, mm-hmm. miles from anybody else.
So you're dealing with anti-aircraft fire from the ground.
Usually we didn't have that much if you're at sea.
But if you are at sea, ships can be firing at you. Yeah. Enemy planes in the air could be firing at you.
Right. You got to think, I was at the end of the war.
Right.
The Japanese didn't have many planes left. Mm-hmm. They were lucky to take care of themselves without being aggressive.
And, you know, you talked about bombing factories and stuff like that. And there are different kinds of bombing runs too, right? You could have a dive bomb, a skip bomb, a glide bomb. What were kind of the different methods you used to try to get those bombs where they were supposed to go?
Yeah, it was always up to your leader when you were going in. But like you say, you might have 10 different things you're trying to hit. So you use a different approach to each one of them. You'd get as close to putting them right on the spot, almost sitting them out individually, as just throwing them out and scatter bombing, yeah.
And I guess that's what I want to understand is, how do you do that? And was there an incident or two that you remember that you say, boy, I did that pretty well that time?
Well, you do it with your wingman. You'd be two of you will do the same thing at the same time. The wingman is firing and dropping. And he might not even see what he's dropping it on. Mm-hmm. But so you got two planes doing what one plane is doing. So it's all pretty automatic. You don't see what you're doing or what you accomplish until mm-hmm. somebody else tells you. Later on, you're so fast going by it all,
yeah.
You can't see anything. Yeah, you're not going to stop and look.
And we have heard you talk about the confidence and the assurance required to be a fighter pilot, but your family tells me you've also remarked over the years about being scared or feeling some level of concern on every single mission.
And the older you got, I think the worse it got, because you realize what could happen.
Well, he's still here and headed for birthday number 100 in December, so we know the worst that could have happened didn't happen, but he did come pretty close. If you haven't found that video online yet of Jack telling the story of how he lost his teeth, don't worry. He's going to tell us right here on the radio when we come back. You'll find that short video at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, along with photos of Jack then and now, and some links to more information about his older brother, Frank, one of those 79 courageous Americans who carried out the Doolittle Raid 80 years ago. I also want to thank loyal Hometown Heroes listener Arnold Martinez for introducing me to Jack Kapler and his family. Arnold interviews World War II vets wherever he finds them, and he preserves their memories. And you know, if we all did that with just the veterans in each one of our circles, well, I guess I'm kind of preaching to the choir when it comes to this audience. Hometown Heroes is going to be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.